No, we're not gonna play now. If you wanna play, you can take that out. No, not now.
All right. For the record, this is an interview with Charlotte Hall Reed on Thursday, April 2, 1992. I'm Robert Estabrook. Let's start, Charlotte, by just a few facts about you. Tell us where and when you were born.
I was born June 8th, 1918 at Charter Oak Hospital in Hartford, hospital which is now defunct. I gather that my mother went to Hartford rather than having me born here or at Sharon Hospital because she had some complications. It has kept me from being a born at home.
Member. You're not truly a native of Salisbury.
I'm not truly a native. So that is what happened.
You remind me of the first week we were here when I saw an op-ed in the in our favorite newspaper and it said, although not a native, he came to Salisbury at the age of 3 weeks.
Oh, no. Oh, that's pretty funny. I didn't read that.
Now, tell me a minute about your parents.
My father was the son of a minister, born, I think, down in Chester or Essex.
In Connecticut.
Went to Yale in the class of 99, came to Hotchkiss the year after to teach, taught here from 1900 to 1935. He married my mother. My mother always said, in order to get out of dormitory duty, and they lived their married life on Elm Street in Lakeville. My grandfather had been in the lumber business.
He was E.W. Spurr.
He was E.W. Spurr. He started the E.W. Spurr Company, which is now in 1992 called Community Lumber. The E.W. Spurr Company started actually in Falls Village. That was the main store. And my grandfather used to drive his horses and carriage over Falls Mountain every day back and forth. The road, again, as of 1992, no longer exists in any passable form. I've often said that my grandfather had delusions of grandeur, and he built the rather enormous house in which my family was born and raised.
This was the house on Elm Street?
On Elm Street.
Yes.
Then I remember that labor was a dollar a day, and because we found some old records. And so I guess he was obviously able to afford
now,
it.
Now, the E.W. Spurr Company became Community Service.
My family sold it in the late 1920s to Sid Coles and Gus Hotchkiss, and that's when it became Community Service.
Right. Now, do you remember your grandfather was...
No. My family was a strange one. My mother, my grandmother on my mother's side was a Hall. My grandmother married a Spur, and then her daughter, my mother, married a Hall. It was funny, but anyway.
There were previous Halls in the family then.
In the family, no relation.
No relation.
My grandmother was 16 when my aunt was born, and then there was a gap of 22 years before my mother was born.
My goodness.
So that the mother and the older sister were closer of an age than the two sisters. And I think the reason my grandfather built such a big house on Elm Street was because my aunt, as I have heard the story, was engaged to Senator Barnum at one point.
The
house is built, if you're ever in it, so that part of it can be shut off with sliding doors, and the thought was that the senator and his wife would maintain an apartment there and be there in the summer, and my mother and her family would occupy the house in the winter. My father had started Key Waden Camps, which was a chain of boys' camps, and they would, my side of the family would have been off in the summer. So I think that's the reason the house was built as it is.
For the record, this was Senator William Barnum of the Barnum Richardson Company.
Right.
Who lived in Lime Rock, I
lived
believe.
In Lime Rock, yes.
And he died in 1889, am I right,
mm-hmm.
or thereabouts? Grover Cleveland came to the funeral.
Yes,
heard that.
That's right. But my aunt and my mother were so far apart in age that I guess this was
yes.
possible.
Now, what did your father teach?
He taught American history to mainly juniors and seniors.
And he retired in the late 19, you said 35.
He died in 1935.
He
yes.
was still teaching at the
He
time
was still
of
teaching,
this, I
yeah.
see. And your mother?
Oops, excuse me, there's my Phoebe returned. I always wonder how a Phoebe can find its way all the way back. It's the first time I've seen it this spring. So anyway, it comes and catches flies.
Your mother lived for some years after your father's death?
Yes, she lived into the late 1950s. When she died, we were just at the point of making, Gordon, my husband, was at the point of making a career change. Somewhat long story, which I won't...
Yeah, well, I want to ask you about Gordon
yeah.
in a minute.
We did, at that point, when she left us the house, we moved up here. And I've been here ever since, pretty much.
Uh-huh. Now, have you brothers or sisters?
I have an older brother, or I had an older brother. He died last year. He was 9 years older than I, and I had a brother who died as an infant in between the two of us. But
so you were the youngest?
I was the youngest.
Yes, indeed. Now, tell us a bit about your own education.
Heavens.
You went to school.
I went to school in what was the predecessor of Town Hill School. Actually, Mother taught me at home, so I went into school.
Was she an educator herself?
No, she just enjoyed uh-huh. teaching. So I never went to school till the fourth grade, and then went to the predecessor of Town Hill School, which was in what I guess is still called Bissell Hall up at Hotchkiss. It was a very small group. And in fact, when we graduated, there were only two of us in the graduating class, Mary Helen Hawley Hotchkiss and myself. I then, I guess at that point, my family, for whatever reason, felt it would be best if I went to boarding school, and I went to the school in Great Barrington in that castle, which is off
Searle's
the main
castle.
Street, Searle's Castle, and was there for...
What was the name of that school?
Barrington School for Girls.
Oh my goodness.
And we had a rather strange headmistress who believed that parents should not bring the children to school, so three of us from this town who went there as boarders had to go to Canaan and ride up on the train so that we wouldn't
did
have...
ride up on the Berkshire Line.
Berkshire Line. Actually, my first train ride, years before that, when I was about 7 or 8, was from Lakeville to Salisbury, and I walked home.
On the Central New England, then?
On the, yes,
so
on the Central New England.
So you have recollections of when it still had passenger trains.
Yeah, absolutely.
Wonderful.
So... anyway, after Barrington School, I was, because of having been taught at home, I was very young. I was only 12 when I graduated. And so they decided to try to fill in, I guess I was almost 13. They filled in a year by sending me to Washington, to Mount Vernon Seminary. And then...
Washington, D.C., yes.
Yeah, Washington, D.C. And then I went to Barnard for 4 years. Graduated from there, and then went
39.
Right. Went to Bank Street College for a year and got my teaching certificate in New York State. Now they give an MA, but then they gave only a teaching certificate. Then, when I graduated from Barnard, I guess when I was still at Bank Street, Ralph Ingersoll. Decided to start his newspaper, an experimental newspaper without advertising in New York called PM. And because he lived in Lakeville part-time, I did know him, and he saw fit to hire me to supposedly write an education column. I never ended up writing anything of the sort.
What did you write?
I was mostly writing features for the Sunday section. I remember vividly that we ran a contest to pick what they called New York's average girl. And we picked a child's waitress who was very photogenic, but practically speechless. And so I had to take her on major adventures, like going to meet Gary Cooper or going to sit with Mayor LaGuardia for a while. And then we'd go back to the office, and I would write these impressions that she'd had in my own words. That was.
What was Mayor LaGuardia like?
Oh, he was charming. This was the era when he was reading the comics over the radio because of the newspaper strike, and so he was quite relaxed, actually, and seemed to enjoy this little episode in his busy day.
Well, he was much more urbane than you might think from his background there, because he'd been a member of Congress for quite a few
years.
That's
right. No, he was, I thought, quite charming. Anyway, then, let's see, after PM, I worked for the Office of War Information during the Second World War.
Did you go to the Nation directly from PM, or was that later?
No, that was later.
Yes.
I worked at the New York office of the Office of War Information. And then we were married. Gordon was working for the State Department, so we moved to Washington.
This is a good time to break in and ask you to tell us about Gordon. What was his background? Where did you meet?
He was born in Brooklyn, went to Brooklyn Polytech, and then to Amherst. He worked for the Foreign Policy Council and for the Office of Inter-American Affairs under Nelson Rockefeller.
He was always interested in Latin Inter-American Affairs.
Right.
Yes.
And then when we were married, at that point, he had amoebic dysentery badly in Latin America. So he took a job which kept us in Washington. And
had he been in the Foreign Service, or was he a State Department employee as such?
Actually, when he was in Latin America, he was working for the Foreign Policy Council.
Oh, I see.
With some government sponsorship, because he was supposedly tracking down Japanese spies in various Latin American countries. But he did get quite sick and had to be brought home on a stretcher and to the lay clinic and so on. And so anyway, we had a very happy, I guess it was about 12 or 13 years in Washington. He was very musical, and so in addition to working for the State Department in the Latin American section, he was head of the board of the National Symphony, so that we got to meet a lot of Washingtonians as well as government people, and it was fun. I loved it.
This was when Howard Mitchell was conductor, or was it before then?
No, it was Gordon and a man named Lloyd Symington were instrumental in getting the previous conductor out and getting Howard Mitchell in. And so it was during Howard Mitchell's time. Howard was good at first, but deteriorated over the years a bit.
The situation outgrew him.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Now, Gordon continued to work in Central American affairs or Latin American affairs. Until about when?
I think we moved back in 1956. I'm awful on dates. But Congress had passed something called the Riston Act, which meant that he would have had to go back into the field. They did not any longer tolerate the division between department people, such as Gordon and Foreign Service. And he didn't want to go back in the field. So we moved back. And at that point, we had three sons. A fourth one was born after we got back here. And for 2 years, Gordon taught at Amherst and came home on weekends. And then we had 1 year of being down at the University of Connecticut, where he was acting dean of men for a year.
At Storrs?
At Storrs.
Oh my goodness. Were you living at Storrs?
We lived at Storrs. We moved the whole family down. And and then we came back here and settled in. And he took a job at Salisbury School teaching Spanish and doing admissions. So.
Well, that's an interesting, certainly, background to your own career here in Salisbury. Now, did you do some teaching here yourself?
I taught in Washington and also at one point worked not for the nation but for the New Republic. And then came back here and worked teaching remedial reading, and in the meantime did graduate work at both Fairfield University and the University of Hartford to get my degree as what was then known as a psychological tester. It's now become a school psychologist. But I worked at the Mental Health Center, and I worked in Winsted at the Shared Services office there. And then came back here, and I guess I'm trying to think how it went. In 1973, I ran for first selectman, and you know.
Well, you had already been chairman of the school board for quite some
years.
Yes. Did your teaching make you gravitate toward this?
I think having young children makes many candidates for the school board gravitate.
Well, let's break in here and ask you about each of your children, and then we'll come back to your career.
David Reed is one of the managing editors at the Providence Bulletin, Journal Bulletin in Providence. Dwight does the computer. He's, I guess, in charge of computers for Crane Paper in Dalton outside of Pittsfield. Douglas and Daniel, who live here in Lakeville on either side of me, are both carpenters. And each of my four sons now has two children, so I'm happily a grandmother of eight.
You're an octuple grandmother, yeah. Not an octogenarian, but an octuple.
Almost.
Very, very so. Good. Well, now you served on the school board for how many years?
16.
Really? And you were chairman for 12
eight.
Of those? Eight?
Eight. Mm-hmm.
And then in 1973, you ran for first selectman to succeed Bill Barnett.
Right.
And you yourself were first selectman for
16
years.
Mm-hmm.
Which is,
yeah.
So this makes 32 years of public
meetings.
Service in Salisbury.
Evening meetings. Yeah.
You must have a very considerable tolerance for sitting through endless discussions.
Well, I think that may be why, when in these later years I've gone to work part-time for the Lakeville Journal, the only thing I stipulated with Bob Hatch when he hired me was that I would not cover meetings.
So, well, you must have found a lot of stimulus and exhilaration as well as tedium during your 16 years as first selectman. What was your greatest satisfaction in this period?
Oh, heavens. Certainly, let's tackle it the other way first. The greatest sorrow was obviously the burning of the town hall.
Oh, yes.
And all of the turmoil that followed therefrom. As far as satisfaction, I think I enjoyed a feeling of, because of my background, being born here and brought up here, of being able to move into various circles, be it talking to the road crew or to some of the older people whom I'd known for most of my life, as well as to the newcomers who perhaps didn't find me too unsophisticated.
You consider yourself a bridge between both cultures, if you will.
I think so, and perhaps when I came into office, all of the first selectmen, including Bill Barnett, of whom I was very fond, were still very much of an era when the first selectman was the road foreman and did much more of a working day-by-day job. I think that I was able to make the town go from that to something a little more of today, in that we had to deal with the state a great deal more. I didn't mind that too much. I felt
you had training for it.
Yeah, I guess. Who's to say whether it's good or bad that we now have to be so enmeshed with the state, but we do, and in a way I jumped in and tried to make Salisbury a factor in on state commissions and boards, and worked at it.
Well, it would be overdrawing it to say you brought Salisbury from the horse and buggy age into the computer age, but in a sense you brought it to the time of professional management.
Yeah, that's better put, I think, than I could. And I think I also enjoyed the good years, in that my working relationships with the Board of Finance were really very good throughout, and there wasn't the question that there now is of tremendous economies and people fighting for their own special interests in
right.
town government, and so I was lucky.
It was happier. Well, now, you talked about some of your satisfactions, and I hope you'll talk a minute about solid waste and what you did about it, because I particularly look upon this as a monument to Charlotte Reed's foresight. We were really a leader in the whole state.
Well, it was a difficult problem, because when I came into office in 1973, it was almost at the end of a contract which Bill Barnett, my predecessor, had worked out, and which was working very well with the family, the Harold Erickson family. And I'd been in office only a couple of weeks when Harold Erickson came in and said, "We're not going to renew the contract. You have no place to take your garbage." And it immediately became important to try to find a solution. And there had been a study committee, because I think Bill had anticipated this might happen. And I'm not sure, but you were on that study committee,
no.
Were you? They had picked, I think it was maybe 7 sites in town which might be possible for a new dump. And there was something wrong with every one of them. And also, the neighbors were already getting into the mood that is so prevalent now, that they didn't want anything like that
NIMBY.
Near them. Yeah, NIMBY. And we cast around. There was actually one other transfer station operating in the state at that time, in Plymouth Terryville. And we went and visited that and thought that it might be possible for here. And it took a lot of negotiating with Hotchkiss to get the land and with the state to approve it. But eventually, I think it was 1975, with May 1st, that we opened. And it's worked quite well to have a central place where the garbage can go and then be transported to a bigger place.
Did you solicit the site from Hotchkiss, or was this offered?
We solicited it, yeah.
But it was really a very happy solution to the whole thing, wasn't it?
I hope so. We'd like to have had it a little bit bigger, but there
it
is.
It served.
It serves, yes.
And was it your idea to merge with Sharon in it?
Yes.
Yes, which really made it viable. It gave you twice the clout.
The clout, I think, yeah, and the volume. So. But.
Well, that's very good. Well, talk a little bit about the currents in town that brought about a tragedy like the town hall fire?
Well, I think for many, many years, Salisbury has had a split personality long before I came on the scene between some of the people who maybe could trace their ancestry back to the Iron Days, people whose fathers and grandfathers were probably very hardworking citizens, but maybe as the generations went on, some of these people felt that the town wasn't doing right by them and were quite resentful. Wasn't a large group. You could probably number in the 20s or 30s. But one family in particular, named the Dunces, as we all know, there were three young men who were particularly resentful of anything which they thought was a slight on them. They may even, many people have speculated, have had genes which predisposed them to violence. Anyway, one of those people, Roy, worked for the town road crew. He had a history of problems with alcohol, as many of the group did. But he could be charming and hardworking when he was sober, but once under the influence, he could get very violent. And I had to fire him after several reprieves for drunkenness. I particularly remember one night when I was down at the garage at 10 in the evening because we'd had a bad snowstorm, and he came in to work and was drunk. And so when the time came to fire him, he went away quite sullen and obviously harbored a deep resentment against me whenever he was drunk. And so on that night of August 5th, 1985, he apparently decided to set fire to the town hall. He had previously set fire to the town garage, we now know. But the town hall was even more devastating for the community.
Now, there was a trauma for everybody who lived here, without any question. Did you ever feel threatened by him or his brothers?
Not at the time. I was given police protection for a couple of weeks afterwards when no one really did feel they knew who had done it. But no, not particularly.
Unfortunately, it wasn't just the one, because both other brothers got into the act as
right.
a result of this one. Did you have much dealing with either of them?
Richard had worked at the transfer station for a while, but
he's the one who was convicted of the murder of Earl Morey.
Right. Richard left the transfer station, as I remember, of his own volition, so there was no feeling that he had resentment against me.
Another factor in this was the teen center, which operated. Was this a suggestion of the mental health center in the first place to set it up, or was it your initiative?
Well, I think it was the mental health center that suggested. We felt it would be a good idea at the time. It certainly never worked.
This was located above the jewelry store at the corner of Route 41 and 44 in Lakeville,
right.
in a town-owned building.
Right. I think the reason a teen center has worked in Sharon and doesn't work here, or didn't work here, may be partly that Salisbury's always prided itself on a recreation program, which to the group which included the Dunces always appeared to be a goody-goody enterprise and didn't touch them in any significant way. And so when the teen center was set up, it became a us and them situation. And as you well know.
But it was really Asa Flint who wrecked the place, wasn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah.
Made it impossible to continue.
Wonder where he is. I have no idea.
I don't know either. Talk a little bit about your vision for Salisbury 10, 20, 50 years from now. What do you think it will be? What should it be?
I don't have any particular insight that those who've been working on planning committees about that future haven't hit on already. I think I see a trend which bothers me at the moment, in that I hear a lot of our young couples, including one of my sons, including a local plumber and his wife, plus some of our retirees saying, we're going to move to North Carolina or South Carolina. The opportunities are more there. Connecticut's stagnating. We want to get out. And I find that a disturbing trend. I don't know whether it's going to become bigger or whether it's just that I know, well, perhaps four or five couples actually now who are talking in this vein.
And this is not for reasons of winter climate or things like that.
No, several of them are good golfers, and golf has become such a hot item in the United States, and this is something they'd like to do more of the year. But at the same time, I think it's more the economic opportunities seem rosier to them down there.
Well, do you see Connecticut on the decline?
I do, even though the New York Times yesterday said the state had the highest income.
Yeah.
Of any.
Yeah. Well, to interject, what do you think could be done to arrest that?
Encouragement of business, certainly, of small business.
Which means a different tax climate in part.
Yes, yes. North Canaan is talking in these terms, and North Canaan, I think, has a slightly different approach than we do. I mean, I hear them talking about outlets such as you find in Manchester, Vermont, or Fall River. I don't think that's for Salisbury, but I do think small businesses like Dottie Smith's or whatever would be wonderful if we can find ways to attract
them. What would be one way we might attract them here?
I think you're right. The tax climate, a more vigorous chamber of commerce, more effort by the town government to contact some of the state agencies that are encouraging small business.
Is zoning too tight to effectuate this?
Maybe.
Without any criticism, because I'm sure people have done what they thought was right on it. But
yeah.
I hear this complaint, and
yes.
I wonder how much validity there is.
I think it may be. I think that zoning isn't listening to the people. I think they've gotten so wrapped up in their regulations and rewriting their regulations that they don't really listen. They don't call in the Michael Flints or the young business people in a way that's constructive.
Should the town acquire some land that it might lease for purposes of non-polluting light industry or something like that?
Would be nice. There's not a lot of available land.
Should the Salisbury Association earmark something like this?
I think it would be better than renovating the Academy building, which they're trying to call the meeting house, which is annoying several people because the church is the meeting house and always has been.
This is the way it is, isn't it?
Yep.
Let me just pay attention to this thing a little bit here. You see in this town. Start with the special qualities you see in Salisbury.
Just the physical setting is stupendous. I think so many people who go away do miss the green of the hills if they go to Arizona. certainly the special quality can be pretty much summed up in the word volunteerism up until now. The very fact that you're sitting here being interested in doing, hey, come on, excuse me, my dog. I hope that the spirit that you and I know and the Ben Belchers and others will continue, and I'm confident that it will.
You don't see any diminution of it, do you?
No, I don't.
We have a good flow of newcomers and weekend people who are interested in associating with the town.
Yeah. No, I think this is a very special quality in Salisbury. It's, again, I've used this word before today, but it's a bit more sophisticated than the volunteerism in some of the surrounding towns. It's different.
Because there are people from every background here.
Right.
Who maybe it's just an accident of scenic circumstances brought them together. Mm. But it's more than that.
It's something I think we have to foster, and I think we are doing it now, which is great. I don't think it'll happen all by itself always. I was saying to someone on the school board the other day, I mean, they're saying, oh, we're going to have to cut programs because of the budget and this, so on and so forth. And I was mentioning that when we were building the town hall, one of the things I did, which I thought really perhaps was good, was I made out a wish list of things that we needed and then specifically asked people whether they'd be willing to contribute this particular item. I tried to pair the item with the person.
What a bright idea. That's how you got the weather vane.
The weather vane, because that artist was interested, the paint from Benjamin Moore, so many people got involved, from the banks to the Wagner McNeil Insurance, you know, it was just, and I think you could do that with the school saying, we need a volunteer in such and such a classroom for such and such hours every week, and kind of matching the people to the jobs. And if it's done right, they'll, I think, welcome it.
That's wonderful. Well, in a sense, despite the tragedy of the town hall, I suppose that you could say that it brought us closer together on something like that.
It did. It did, I think. But I'm not sure that part of it was worth the...
No, the drama was...
The splitting that occurred at several points during the reconstruction.
Well, yeah. Talk a bit about some of the notable old-timers you remember who bridged the little men on the mountain or the Iron Era.
Well, certainly, Bill... You don't want background noise from the dog with its bone. We can. Bill Rainsford was one. I don't know. Do you remember him?
He was before my time. I think he had died when we came.
Well, Bill was a great, big, heavyset man who really ruled the town in many ways. He, more than anybody else in the early days, bridged the gap between the then newcomers and the townspeople. He was justice of the peace, and I think many of us can still remember the court that he would hold in the courthouse building, actually, upstairs.
This was before the circuit court.
Before the circuit court.
The AP courts.
And he knew all those young miscreants who were coming up before him, and he would lecture them, and he was tough on them, but boy, they listened, and it was fun to go hear him in court.
And I've heard tales of how he would see to it that the punishment was administered by whitewashing the fence or whatever right then.
Right then, and he would see that it was done. He ran a contracting business. It wasn't very big. He had three employees, but he was also a legislator in Hartford. And a charming, good sense of humor. I always remember Lila Nash, our town clerk, commenting the week that he died, that three people had died that week of lung cancer, and not one of them smoked, which was an interesting little sidelight. Lila Nash, of course, is another old-timer whom you and I both knew. She's was not always easy to deal with, as I found out when I became first selectman. She was looked upon as the source of all information about the iron industry in the early days, but not it was not always
some
accurate.
Some of which was wrong.
But I think as we look back on it, and look back on Lila with her funny hats and her hairdo and all of it, she was quite a character.
She was colorful. And
very
she
colorful.
She was very dedicated.
Yeah.
Do you think the JP system, looking back, was better than what we get now in some respects?
Oh, I think so. Of course, the town was, well, seemed smaller then, because we didn't have the influx of weekend people. So it really was, you knew everyone much more than you know now.
And this was before certain Supreme Court decisions made
right.
the administration of justice perhaps a little more difficult
right.
for the
absolutely
administrators.
Yes. Then we had Hugo Pavola and his wife. Did you know
no,
them?
I didn't know them. Well, tell me about
you did know them?
No.
They had a little stationery store across from the post office where the seamstress is now is. And it was cluttered, full of stuff. And the Hotchkiss boys used to come down regularly because in those days, the Hotchkiss boys were much more a part of the community. They were down in droves almost every afternoon to eat at the Jigger Shop or shop at Hugo's. Hotchkiss didn't have a store of its own on campus for stationery and pencils and stuff. And Mrs. Pavola was convinced that any Hotchkiss boy that came into her store was going to steal. So she would follow them around, up and down, up and down. And I would have thought they would have not come back, but they seemed to.
Now this was part of the function that Darwin Miller and his wife later
took over.
That's right. Yeah.
That's right. Then there was Doc Leverty, who ran a drugstore where you never knew him either.
No, well, the Holly Block was gone before
oh, that's
we came.
True.
But,
yeah. It was in where the little Bicentennial Park now is. There was a big building, and he had a drugstore on the ground floor. And he, too, was quite a character. He would peer at you over his glasses. And most of the kids that I knew were scared to death to go in there because he was so sharp and critical, and he was, but I gather from some of the older people that he really had a heart of gold underneath all this.
Oh, yes. Did he sell to Gentile then?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because we knew them before
yeah.
they retired. What about the people like Harris Rossiter? Did you come in contact with him very much?
George Kiefer is going to be a better source for all that group. He's full of
well,
stories.
Well, I should make an
yeah.
effort to
I think actually he has recorded a few somewhere for, I'm not sure with oral history or what, of Harris Rossiter's stories. But you better allow a long time because
well,
George has so many stories
well,
of those days.
I hope we can get them down.
Mm. Yeah.